Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin's our guest. And if you didn't know that, if you could see our phones, you would know it because they just stay lit up when Jimmy's here. And that means we've got lots and lots of calls to get through. As lines open up, I will let you know so you can call with your question because it's Ask Me Anything Catholicism and Ask Me Anything. You could almost take the modifier off it with Jimmy because he'll talk to you about anything. He really will talk to you about anything. Maybe not sports ball, but you got anything else you want to talk about? 888-318-7884. Jimmy,
just to give people a sense of what else they could ask about with me, they can ask about philosophy. You know, in addition to religious subjects, they could ask about philosophy. They could ask about science. They could ask about weird stuff. They could ask about lots of things.
Yeah. Well, more than 300 episodes now of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yeah.
And you haven't even started to scratch the surface of all of the things you're interested in. I think your list must be...
Oh, yeah. It's over 2,000 items on the list.
Yeah. Yeah. So call and ask if you got a question. 888-318-7884. Tomorrow's Mysterious World. They drop each Friday morning. A new episode drops each Friday morning. Tomorrow's Mysterious World, which you can find at mysterious.fm, has weird questions. So you get all kinds of weird stuff tomorrow. And you can just call and ask it here, too, if you got one of your own. 888-318-7884.
Yeah. Yeah, people don't have to wait till a weird question show to ask a weird question. I'll answer them anytime.
You and I both have had this experience. I don't know. This is a pretty weird one, Jimmy.
And then it's not that weird.
Invariably not that weird when the person says that.
Not invariably, but
sometimes. Frequently, yeah, right. That's true. All right, off to Missouri we go. We start in Missouri this hour. Michael on YouTube, thank you for waiting through the break. Michael, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, I want to preface this by saying that I've had to go to confession often for this sort of thing, confessing anger and confessing being uncharitable. So I have this problem where I interact with Protestants a lot, and it kind of ends in a terrible blowout, and the logical approach isn't working. So my question is, how can I better interact with Protestants when they slander the Catholic Church and bear false witness?
Well, so there was a figure, I guess, a couple hundred years ago. This may have actually been Napoleon, if I recall correctly, who said, if you meet someone, I think it was, who doesn't believe in God, then if you are a scholar, you try to convince him with persuasive words. And if you are an ordinary man, you take out your sword and shove it into his stomach as far as it will go.
Napoleon going to do it, too.
Yeah. Now, I think that there are probably laws against that here in America today, so you may not want to do that. What I would say is you want to be charitable. Even if someone you're having a dispute with is being a jerk, you want to be better than them because, number one, if you're able to be loving, then that will please God because he wants us to be loving, and it will cause the person you're having a dispute with to think. One of the things that St. Paul says is, if someone is abusing you, give them a gentle answer and heap hot coals on their head, meaning coals of shame when they realize they've overreacted and are being a jerk and you're being nice to them. So that's what I try to do. I work in apologetics professionally. That means I deal with a lot of jerks, not all of them non-Catholic. And I developed a thick skin. I even had it before I was Catholic because I'm also a philosophy. I'm an analytic philosopher. And what you do in philosophy grad school is you sit around a table with other philosophy grads and you tear down each other's arguments bit by bit. And it's not personal. You don't take it personally. This is just the process of critique. And so you learn how not to take things personally. And that's a key part of Christian maturity, which is learning how not to take things personally and being able to distance yourself from the emotion so that you don't get caught up in the same emotion. You may recognize, someone, oh, by the way, speaking of emotions, you don't need to confess anger Anger is an emotion. It's not a sin. The Bible says, be angry and sin not. Do not let the sun go down upon your anger, meaning it's okay to be angry, but don't hang on to the anger. Be willing to let it go. So if you have a flash of anger or a few minutes of anger or something like that, okay, but don't hold on to it forever, you know, because that's just going to hurt you. Feeling the anger is a painful emotion, and it's okay to be angry, and anger can even play a constructive role when it motivates you to take constructive action to deal with the problem. But if you're hanging on to anger beyond that, it's a painful emotion, and it's not doing anything constructive, and you're just hurting yourself. So all of us need to learn how to let go of anger. It doesn't mean we forget things that people have done wrong, but it does mean we learn not to dwell on them. And so, you know, if I go on Twitter, which is kind of an anger party a lot of the time, and I see trolls trash talking me, well, I'm not going to take it overly seriously. I'm not going to get bent out of shape about it. Trolls are going to troll, and I'm not going to reward them by, you know, feeding them and reacting to them. I'm just going to let it, it's like water off a duck's back. I'm going to let it, you know, go and not worry about it. And so if you're in a discussion with a Protestant or anybody else that you have a disagreement with, if you can be logical and constructive and charitable and so forth, then it's great to have a discussion with them. But if that's not the case, if it's just turning into a blow up, then I would say pull the brakes. Say, I'm sorry, but I think this conversation is not as constructive as it ought to be, and so I'm afraid we'll just have to agree to disagree for right now. And leave it at that, and look for other constructive things you can do, either with the same person or with somebody else.
And Michael, I hope that that's helpful. I'm going to leave that there and keep moving, try to get to as many as I can. Jim is in Boise, Idaho, listening on Salt and Light Radio. Jim, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
I wanted to ask you about the word Elohim. It's my understanding that it's a plural word. And so I wanted to ask, how should I be looking at it if, you know, when Jesus says, are you not gods? Was he referring to, 'cause I can understand, are you not gods? Because that's plural. But so is it only in the plural sense and not like for the individual?
Okay. So Elohim is a Hebrew word that is in the plural form grammatically. That does not mean it's being, that does not mean it's being used as a plural. There are a variety of words in many languages that are irregular in terms of the forms that they take. For example, here in English, we have the word sheep and the word fish. And sheep and fish look singular in form, but can actually be used as plurals. So for example, and the way you tell whether a word is being used as singular or plural is you look at the surrounding context. You look at the verbs, which also get inflected for number, and you look at the pronouns, which also get inflected for number in English. So if I, just with the word sheep, if I say, I took the sheep out to the field today, and it was so happy. Sykelet, am I talking about one sheep, singular, or more than one sheep, plural? I took the sheep out to the field today.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, so happy. Okay, yeah. You're talking about one sheep.
One sheep, right. So I'm using the word sheep as a singular, and you can tell that because of the singular pronoun it and the singular verb was. Now, suppose I said, I took the sheep out to the field today, and they were so happy. More than one sheep or just one sheep?
That's plural sheep. That's more than one sheep.
That's plural. And what tells you that is it's the plural pronoun they and the plural verb form were. So we can figure out whether a word is being used singular or plural based on the context. We also have words that are plural in form in English but can be used and sometimes always are used as singulars, like pants and scissors. You know, we would never say, I put on my pant today, or I bought a new pant at the store. It is always plural in form, even when we're talking about one thing, And I could say similar, same thing with scissors. We never talk about a scissor. We talk about scissors. And just like with sheep, you can tell whether it's being used as a singular or a plural, even though it's plural in grammatical form, by looking at the context. So if I said, I bought pants today and they filled a warehouse. Well, you can tell by the context, I'm not talking about one pair of pants, because no single pair of pants is big enough to fill a warehouse, but multiple pairs of pants could. On the other hand, if I say, I put on pants today, I'm probably talking about one pair of pants. So you can look at the context to tell, is it one or more than one? And so even though now the singular noun, El in Hebrew, means God, gets pluralized as Elohim. Whenever you see an eem on the end of a Hebrew word, that's a marker that it's plural in grammatical form. But we know that Elohim is sometimes used to refer to just the true God, perhaps as a way of communicating his majesty, you know. Maybe that's the reason, maybe it's not, but it is. And we can tell, like, for example, in Genesis 1, by looking at the pronouns and looking at the verbs, that in Genesis 1, Elohim is being used to refer to a single entity. It's being used as a singular, even though it's plural in form. So it will say things like, on the first day, Elohim said, let there be light, and there was light. And he saw that it was good. So that Elohim said, in Hebrew, that's a singular verb, and he is a singular pronoun. And so the context tells you here, Elohim is being used as a singular, even though it's plural in form. Well, in John 10:34, Jesus is quoting from Psalm 82. Now, he's doing this in John, is recorded in Greek. So it's not going to be Elohim. It's going to be the Greek equivalent. The Greek equivalent of El is Kurios, or Kurioi for plural. But he's quoting from Psalm 82. So we can look at the Hebrew of Psalm 82, where it says God, you know, stands in the assembly of the gods, and he says, you are gods, and despite that, you're acting bad, and you're going to die like men. Okay, so there, if memory serves, it is Elohim, and there you can tell that it is plural because of the context. God says, in essence, I'm going to use a southern form just to make this clear, but what God says is, y'all are going to die like men. And that pronoun, y'all, tells us he's talking to more than one Elohim. He's talking to multiple. So in that case, it is being used to refer to multiple entities. Now, that doesn't settle the question of what kind of entities these are. Like I mentioned in the previous hour, some people have said, oh, they're human judges that are misbehaving. Other people have said, nah, they're celestial beings like angels. But one way or another, in this passage, ye are gods, y'all are gods. That's what ye means. It's plural. Y'all are gods is referring to more than one god, as you can tell by the y'all that's there, the ye, to use the older English version of it, which is also a plural.
Jim, got to go to a break, so we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for the call. It's Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin, our guest, 888-318-7884.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
May is the month of Mary. How are you planning to honor the Blessed Mother? Whether it's planting a Mary garden in your yard, placing flowers by her image in your home, or adorning a statue of her with a handmade crown, there are many ways to express devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary. EWTN invites you to celebrate along with us as we honor our Blessed Mother throughout her month with masses, devotions, TV, and radio specials.
Catholic Answers Live annual conference coming up September 26th through 29th right here in beautiful sunny San Diego. It's called Learn From Me, the Parables, Sermons, and Conversations of Jesus Christ. Dr. Scott Haunt will be one of the speakers, Kimberly Hahn, Dr. William Junker, Father Sebastian Walsh, and Dr. Ray Guarendi will all be there along with all of our apologists. Find out all about it and register if you're ready at CatholicAnswersConference.com. CatholicAnswersConference.com. It's Ask Me Anything this hour. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Ryan is in Illinois watching.
Is it?
What's that?
Is it pronounced Junker or Junker? Because it's a German name.
I'm going to be honest with you. I think I've said it both ways, and I don't actually. I don't actually know. Now that I would naturally pronounce it Junker, but I think Darren, do you know? Is it? Oh, you think it's Junker?
Yeah, it could well be. Just curious.
All right. Oh, he so and you met him, and he went by Junker then. But he could have gotten more German between now and
then. He could have been being polite then too.
Yeah, that's right. Ryan's in Illinois watching on YouTube. Ryan, you are very welcome here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Thank you, guys. My question is, how can God in Exodus 32 say he would destroy Israel and make a nation of Moses when Moses wasn't of the tribe of Judah, which is needed for Christ, given Genesis 49 with the prophecy of the Messiah? And a rational follow-up would be, if God already knew Moses with his free will would pray and he would not destroy Israel, was God lying or deceiving Moses when he said he was going to destroy Israel? Thank you.
Okay, so in the first place, if you take, you know, Genesis 3 as the proto-evangelium, it as a prophecy of Christ, which it's reasonably taken as from a Christian perspective, then it still doesn't tell you much about the Christ. It doesn't tell you in particular what tribe he's going to come from. So if God had, and the promise that he would come from Judah didn't emerge until the time of David. There was no explicit, and really it didn't emerge until after that, but it wasn't until the time of David that God made the tribe of Judah the permanent ruler of the 12 tribes. And it wasn't until after that that a prophecy of a specific future descendant of David was going to be the Messiah. So if God had chosen to destroy Israel and build a new nation out of Moses at the time of the Exodus, well, then Moses' sons would have become the patriarchs of the new tribes. Let's say his son Gershom was the one from whom who would be the ruler tribe, and then God hadn't given a prophecy that it's going to be Judah, so God would be perfectly free to say, okay, the Messiah is going to come now from the tribe of Gershom. So there still would have been a Messiah. The plans for the Messiah would have still gone off, but the circumstances would have changed. So that's one answer to the question. In terms of your other question, we have to recognize that Scripture uses anthropomorphic language. And this is especially true in the earlier portions of Scripture, because as Blessed Pius XII said in his encyclical Humanae Generis, the earlier portions of Scripture, like he was referring specifically to the first 11 chapters of Genesis, or what's known as the primordial history, they communicate in simple and metaphorical language truths to a people but little cultured. Well, okay, by the time of the Exodus, they'd gotten a little more cultured, but they were not as sophisticated as they would come to be at the time of Christ. And so you still have a good deal of anthropomorphic language being used. You can see an example, for instance, in Genesis 3, in proximity to the proto-evangelium, where it says God was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and Adam and Eve hide from him, and God says, "Where are you?" And Adam says, "Well, I heard you coming, and I was afraid, so I hid." Well, okay, but God doesn't literally have a human body, and he doesn't literally make noise when he walks around in the cool of the evening, because he doesn't literally walk. So all of that is anthropomorphic language that is meant to communicate truths to us about God in a metaphorical way. And as the Catechism of the Council of Trent points out, whenever we have language about destruction and God being angry or repentant and stuff like that, that's all anthropomorphic language. It is not literally what God's experiencing. It's depicting him as if he's a human. So the message here when in this passage, after the failure at Kadesh or at the Golden Calf incident, is that Israel had sinned so greatly that it would warrant God in terminating Israel and starting over with Moses. So we shouldn't read this as if it's a literal exchange that is meant to be taken literally. It's meant to communicate information, truths about God and Israel's sin and Moses, but in a way that has been anthropomorphized. So when you read it correcting or taking into account, I should say, the anthropomorphic nature of the passage, then it becomes clear what's being said. Israel had sinned so badly, it would warrant God in wiping them out and starting over with Moses. But fortunately, Moses prays, and God honors that intercession and continues working with Israel.
Thank you, Ryan. I hope that was helpful to you. Andrea is next in Houston, Texas, listening on 1430 AM. Glad you're here, Andrea. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, thank you. My question is, we as Catholics say that Mary is a perpetual virgin. However, Matthew 1:25 seems to contradict this idea of her perpetual virginity. So I'm just wondering, how do we reconcile these two things?
Well, we get questions about Mary's perpetual virginity all the time here at Catholic Answers, and we got a bunch of free resources for you right at Catholic.com about this. You can go into it in great depth. Just go to Catholic.com, type in perpetual virginity or Mary or knew her not until, which is the quotation from Matthew 25, which people are concerned about, where it says that Joseph took Mary home but knew her not until she had born her firstborn child. I've got material on that at my website, too, at jimmyakin.com. And one of the things I got is a piece that was written by St. Jerome, who was a fluent Greek speaker in the ancient world, where he points out that the phrase in Greek that's translated until does not imply a change in circumstance. It sometimes does, but it doesn't always. And so all that can be safely affirmed from Matthew 1:25 is Joseph did not have marital relations with Mary before Jesus was born. And it doesn't tell us anything about what happened afterwards. And you can show that by parallels where the same Greek phrase is used elsewhere in the Greek Bible, like in the Greek Old Testament. You know, the Septuagint translation. It talks there about, just to give one example, it talks about how David's first wife, Michal, the daughter of Saul, you know, she loved David. She got married to David. Saul thought it was going to be a good idea. After David becomes king, David is bringing the ark to Jerusalem, and he's dancing in front of it, you know, and he's praising the Lord with his dancing and stuff. But Michal looks down, and it's like, oh, he's dancing like he's a common man. He's not being dignified enough. And she criticized him for this. And the author tells us, and because she was dissing on David's desire to celebrate the Lord, she had no children until the day she died. And it uses the same Greek. But it does not mean that after the day she died, Michal started popping out children in a post-mortem state. So this shows us that until does not mean, just like in English, if I say Michal had no children until the day she died, it means she didn't have any before. It doesn't tell us anything about what happened afterwards. So even though until, both in English and its equivalent in Greek, can sometimes indicate a change of state after the event in question, it doesn't mandate a change of state after the event in question. And so since we have lots of other evidence for Mary's perpetual virginity, which you can read about at Catholic.com or at JimmyAiken.com, this verse does not block the effect of that other evidence. And so that's a basic answer that I would give on this question.
All right, Andrea.
Thank you.
All right. Check out Catholic.com for all, at least a lot of the materials Jimmy just mentioned. And thank you very much for the call. As has been the case all day, all the phones busy. We've just got lots and lots of folks on the line for Jimmy. And that's, well, I don't know what they're going to ask because it's Ask Me Anything. They can ask whatever they want. As line, well, one line just opened up. I guess that was Andrea. You're welcome to call and use that one line. 888-318-7884. Whatever you've got a question about, we'll do our very best to get you in the next half hour. We'll take this break and be right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ, September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast, visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today. Little bit of groovy music for you there on a Thursday afternoon. Maybe it's a Thursday evening where you are, maybe even a Friday morning. Whatever time it is where you are, we're awful glad you chose to spend it with us. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We got a half hour left, and we got at least a half hour of calls on the line. So on we go with the questions for Jimmy Akin. Sam's in Texas. And Sam, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, I had a question about the papacy. So I found out that there was no Western attendance in the Second Ecumenical Council with the Council of Constantinople. Off the top of my head, it condemned the Macedonian
first Council of Constantinople. There were later ones.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, and for preface, I am a 23-year-old convert to Christianity from atheism, and currently deciphering between Eastern Orthodoxy and Catholicism, but the issue I'm hung up on is the papacy. So how does that reconcile with the Pope having such authority over the Church, even in that instance, let alone the Vatican I claims of a papal infallibility?
Okay. Well, so these are two separate issues. But basically, it does take the ecumenical council issue first. Ecumenical councils have been called periodically in church history for a variety of reasons, and it's not always been possible for the Pope to attend them. You know, even during Vatican II, John the 22nd and Paul the 6th were not in the hall the entire time. You know, they had other duties as Pope that they had to attend to. And sometimes if an ecumenical council was being held away from Rome, like, let's say, in Florence, the Pope needed to be in Rome to do his job, and so he would send a representative. Just like at Vatican II, if Paul the Sixth or John the 23rd wasn't in the hall, he would have a representative there. And so sometimes the Pope would send a representative to these councils, and that person, or sometimes more than one person, was known as the papal legate. In some circumstances, like First Constantinople in the year 381, the Pope may not have even been able to send a representative because travel was very difficult in the ancient world. Communication was much more difficult than it is today. The Catholic understanding, though, is that in order to qualify as ecumenical, meaning binding on the entire church, the Pope needs to either preside and approve over the council, or he needs to at least approve it. And this is the same thing that we have in other situations. Like today, if you're working for the Pope at the Vatican, like, let's say you're in the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, and you draft a new document, and everybody at the Dicastery agrees this is a good document, and you decide to publish it, it's just an advisory paper. It has no authority until the Pope approves it. But when it's approved by the Pope, who has authority over the whole church, then your DDF document becomes part of the papal magisterium, and it applies to the whole church. And something analogous happens with ecumenical councils. Now, individual bishops have their own teaching authority, so they don't need the Pope to approve what they say in order for it to be binding. But if what a council says is going to be binding outside of the territory of individual bishops, if it's going to be binding on the whole church, then it needs to be approved by the Pope, because he's the only bishop with the range to affect the whole church. Other bishops have authority in their own territory, but they can't bind people to believe something outside of their territory. And so for a council to be ecumenical, it needs to at least be approved by the Pope, even if he's not there at all, or if he sends a legate, or if he's there some of the time but not every single minute. What ultimately makes something ecumenical is, does the Pope approve of it so that it ends up binding the entire church? Now, infallibility is a separate question, and for that, I'm going to suggest, and it's really more complex than we can go into here, but in my book, Teaching with Authority, I go into conciliar infallibility. That's how infallible councils work, and also papal infallibility. So since Sam is in Texas, I'm going to suggest that we send Sam a copy of Teaching with Authority for free, and he can read all about it.
Hang on, Sam. All we need is an address, and we'll send you Jimmy's book, Teaching with Authority. On we go to Vernon in Houston, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Vernon, welcome. Go ahead with your... can I go to Vernon? Vernon, are you there? I think there's a problem on that line. I apologize, Vernon. I'll come back to you. John's in Springfield, Illinois, listening on 88.9 FM. John, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. I was wondering, first of all, I think it is pronounced Junker.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure, yeah. My name's John, so people would sometimes call me Johan. Mm-hmm. So I'm going with Junker.
People sometimes call me Yakub, which is the Hebrew version of my name.
Okay, I guess I see that. Okay.
I also get called Seamus by friends from Ireland, and Hamish, you know, if someone's from Scotland. There are a bunch of variations on my name.
I see. Well, mm-hmm. Seamus is one that don't hear a lot. I heard it once. Mm-hmm. So I'll get on with my question.
Go ahead.
What can I do for you, Yohanan?
A bit ago, you mentioned you were talking about anger. and you mentioned that it was not a sin. And you were talking about, Psalm 3 or 4, I think. Can you say a little bit about what you were talking about, that anger was not a sin?
Well, anger is an emotion, and emotions are not sins, because in order for something to be a sin, sin is an act of the will. And if you have an emotion, that's a feeling. That is not an act of the will. Now, in the Middle Ages, they would sometimes classify different faculties of the soul, like its intellect and its imagination and its memory and its appetitive or sensitive nature and its will. Well, sin is an act of the will. So what sin is a misuse of the will, where you knowingly and deliberately do something wrong. But that's not the same thing as a feeling. A feeling is something that you don't have full control over, the way you have control over your will. A feeling is a response, and feelings can be physical, like, you know, you could be hungry. That's a physical feeling. If a feeling is mental rather than physical, even though it's going to have a physical correlate in your brain, but if it, and possibly elsewhere in your nervous system, but if you have a mental feeling, we call it an emotion. And so emotions can be classified different ways, but, you know, happiness is an emotion, boredom is an emotion, frustration is an emotion, disgust is an emotion, irritation is an emotion, anger is an emotion. And all of these are just mental feelings, but they're not acts of the will. Now, I may, by using my will, be able to influence my emotion. You know, I may choose to do something that's going to make me happy, like put on some happy music. But it's the act, the choice of the will to put on the music, that's the act of the will. The happiness that results from putting on the happy music, that's a feeling, that's an emotion. It's not an act of the will. And so because emotions are feelings rather than acts of the will, none of them are sinful. So it's not a sin to be happy. It's not a sin to be afraid. It's not a sin to be disgusted. It's not a sin to be irritated. It's not a sin to be angry. It's not a sin to have any mental feeling. The question is, what do you do in that circumstance? If, let's say, you're afraid in a particular situation that there may be an axe murderer on the other side of the door, and rather than finding out, you just shoot through the door and kill whoever is on the other side, not knowing if it's really an axe murderer or not. Well, in that case, you acted on your fear, and the fear wasn't the problem. The problem was what you did in response to the fear. You shot someone not knowing who it is and whether they're really a threat. And in the same way, let's suppose you look at a woman and you think, wow, she is attractive. Well, that's not a sin. That's a feeling. You know, you enjoy looking at this woman. You get pleasure from looking at this woman. Where it becomes a sin is if you say, oh, let's go sleep with her, even though I'm not married to her. It's what you do in response to the feeling that is sinful. And in the same way, if you have anger, it's just a feeling. It's not an act of the will. It's not a sin. But it can lead to sin, just like fear or pleasure can lead to sin, if you do something inappropriate in response to the anger. Like, let's say one day I'm hanging out with Cy Kellett, and he says something that angers me. And what I do is I decide to murder Cy Kellett, because why should Trent Horn have all the fun?
I know, right?
You know?
Yeah.
Well, okay, that's where it's not the anger that was sinful. It's what I did in response to the anger that was sinful, the act of the will where I choose to murder Cy. So that's the basic distinction between an act of a feeling and an act of the will, and sins are only ever acts of the will. They are not feelings.
Sure. Okay, so it's the giving in to the anger, the giving in to the lust, and giving in to the fear and murdering, things like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
John, thanks. That takes us right to the break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything.
Oh, I missed a triple. I could have used murder in all three cases. I see a woman's attractive, so I murder her husband. There we go. To free her up so I can pursue her. I could have done murder in all three cases, but didn't.
Like King David.
Guess I'm not murdery enough.
You need, no, we have much more murderer apologists than you. You're not the murderer-est at all. We'll take a quick break right back with more Jimmy Akin, Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, "When we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue." Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Hi, this is Mike Aquilino with a few words about St. Maximus the Confessor. The emperor wanted to compromise doctrine in order to make peace with heretics. It was all about politics, but Maximus the Confessor dared to oppose him and would not back down. For this, he was charged with treason and had his tongue and right hand cut off so that he could not speak or write against the emperor. His silence resounded everywhere, and truth prevailed.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. Rory is in Arizona. I've always thought that would be a good name for a lion. Rory, listening on Catholic.com. Welcome, Rory. Go ahead with your question.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Very well. Yes, thank you.
Hi, Jimmy. My question is something that you said, actually, in response to Dr. White in your debate on justification. This was about a month ago. You said, James White said, there's no need for satis passio. There is no need for remission of temporal punishments or anything along those lines, which are the dogmatic teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. And then you responded, actually, they're not. I don't think you know what the phrase means. And then Dr. White started laughing. I just wanted to know if you can clarify that, because it seems to me that I think I understand what you're doing. You're kind of separating those concepts from purgatory, but I think there's a danger in separating these things into their constitutive parts, because how do you explain purgatory or indulgences without these concepts?
Well, I explain them the way the magisterium does. So what I was doing in that case, what White was doing was confusing common theological opinion with dogma. And they're very different things. Properly speaking, nothing is a dogma unless the church has infallibly defined that it is part of divine revelation. Okay, so dogmas are a very small set of teachings. They are a subset of infallible teachings. In order for something to be a dogma, the church must have infallibly defined that it is part of divine revelation. If that doesn't happen, it ain't a dogma. Well, White rattled off a number of different things that in connection with purgatory that have different statuses. And like, for example, he mentioned the idea of satis passio. Satis passio is an idea that has been proposed by theologians that will explain what's happening in purgatory, that a person is passively suffering in order to expiate temporal punishments, which are understood as inflicted from without, because typically in this theory by something like fire, like spiritual fire that God's pouring onto a person, or even in some cases, literal fire that God's pouring onto a soul in order to make it suffer so that it will satisfy justice for things it committed during life. Okay, well, that's one understanding of purgatory that's been proposed, but it ain't the only one. And the church has not signed off on that as part of infallibly as part of divine revelation. In fact, if you look at the church's authoritative documents, they don't use that kind of language, and they certainly don't in an infallible context. So satis passio is a theological theory that has been proposed to explain what happens in purgatory, but it is not a matter of Catholic dogma. And so, but in order to kind of inflate Catholic claims, which is a form of strawmanning in the minds of the audience, White tosses around the term dogma when it's not appropriate. Now, do I think he knows what he's doing? No, I don't think White understands the concept of dogma, not as the term is used in the Catholic Church. And so he just tosses out this language in a sloppy fashion without understanding what he's really saying. But this would be an example of something where he's wrong. Satis passio is not an infallibly defined dogma. And I think it's important to be clear on what is and what is not dogma. So that's why I said just briefly, you know, no, these ideas are not all dogma that you're proposing. I don't think you understand what that term means, because I don't think he does. There are other understandings of purgatory that do not involve satis passio, not as it's been classically articulated. Like, for example, Pope Benedict XVI's description of how purgatory works in the mind, in his mind and in the minds of other theologians, where it is conceived of as a encounter with the fiery love of Jesus Christ that burns away our impurities, which are understood in the catechism as our disordered desires. So an encounter with the transforming holiness of Christ's love makes us totally loving ourselves. And that's a very different understanding than you go to purgatory and you passively suffer as God pours spiritual or literal fire onto your soul to punish you from without for things you committed during life. That is not the way the Magisterium articulates this. That's a historic theory, but it's not church teaching. In fact, if you look in the catechism, it says that these sufferings, including those of hell, are not to be understood as inflicted from without. It's not like God's got you in a torture chamber and is poking you from without to make you suffer. These sufferings are understood by the Magisterium today as following from the very nature of the sin itself. So, for example, if you reject God utterly, you're cutting yourself off from the source of life and joy. And of course you're going to be frustrated. That's what hell is. If you have disordered desires that would prevent you from enjoying God's presence, then yeah, those will be corrected, and it may not be 100% fun for you, but it's because you're being given a cure. Kind of like I mentioned earlier in a previous call about if Psychelet's broken his arm and I need to yank it to get it into position so it'll heal correctly, Psy will have a little bit of pain. But this isn't a suffering I'm just inflicting on Psy from without. I'm doing it to help him. And in the same way, the fiery transforming love of Christ might, for example, make us ashamed of all the things we've done that were unloving. But by passing through that, we learn our lesson to be loving and completely so. And so there are different models for understanding how things like purgatory or indulgences work. And White has an unfortunate and repeated tendency. He doesn't really read, this is my experience, but in my experience, he doesn't really read other people's positions to understand them. He doesn't read sympathetically. He reads looking for ammunition. And what that causes him to do is find any passage that he can take, and not just against Catholicism, it's against anything. He finds any passage that he can take in a negative sense and assumes that's what it means, and then attributes maximal authority to it. And that leads him to not carefully distinguish between what's actual magisterial teaching and what's some theological opinion. Like he noted, well, F.X. Choupé, whose name he didn't pronounce right, but that's not a big deal. F.X. Choupé had satis passio and things like this in his understanding. It's like, yeah, and as I pointed out, he's not Pope. This is not magisterial teaching, and it's certainly not infallible magisterial teaching, and it's certainly not infallible magisterial teaching that has been defined as part of divine revelation, and so it is not dogma.
Rory, going to leave it there. Going to keep moving, see how many I can get on with Jimmy. Paolo is in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, listening on Catholic.com. Paolo, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thanks. Hi. Jimmy, my question was about the real presence in adoration. Mm-hmm. When I look at Old Testament prefigurations of the Eucharist, whether it's, you know, Isaac, Passover, manna, the manna from heaven, and then the fulfillment in the New Testament with Jesus saying, unless you eat my flesh and or take this and eat it, it almost leads me to believe that eating is a important part of the form of the sacrament, maybe in completing it. So the question is, can you be Catholic and believe in the real presence at Mass, but not at adoration in a monstrance?
No, because this actually is a part of dogma. When the Protestant movement began, one of the theories that was proposed in Lutheran circles is that the real presence is only present when the sacrament is in use, meaning effectively at Mass or at the Lord's Supper or whatever you want to call it. And the presence or the real presence would cease after that. And the Council of Trent did address that issue and did address it infallibly and says, no, once the transformation happens, it's Jesus, and it doesn't go back to being bread and wine. So so this actually is a point of infallible church teaching that, understood in context, is generally understood as an actual matter of dogma.
Okay, Paolo?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right, very good. Joseph in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Go ahead, Joseph, with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. I didn't think I was going to be able to get through.
But you did it.
I'd have to wait for the...
Well, yeah, you did, but we're really... Joseph, we're totally close to the end break. I want to give you an answer. What's your question?
Oh, okay. Being the master purveyor of weird, Jimmy, I would... My guess is that you would be familiar with the legend of Lilith.
Yep.
So what would you like to know about Lilith?
Supposedly being Adam's first wife, and because she didn't want to be subordinate to him, but his equal, she ended up running off with a demon, and supposedly became the queen of the demons or the queen of the succubus.
I think I had actually
encountered a succubus.
Oh, really?
Where I was awakened one morning.
Okay, Joseph, just as a reminder, this is a family show, so we can't go too much into what succubi do. If you're currently being bugged by something you perceive as a succubus, contact me by emailing me at jimmy@catholic.com, and we can have a discussion in a forum where we don't have children listening. But for now, is there a question you have for me that I can help you with? Because we only have a very few moments before the music starts.
Okay. Well, okay. How about a follow-up on the Nephilim?
Okay.
What I thought, you know, where it's stated in Genesis that the sons of God found the daughters of man to be fair and so had relations with them. Mm-hmm. I took the original sons of God to be the original fallen demons.
All right, I'm going to let Jimmy comment on that just because we only have 30 seconds left.
Okay, the way Second Temple Jewish literature understands the fall of angels and the origin of demons is it's not just one thing. It's there, apparently Satan had fallen earlier than this. Some angels fell at the time of Genesis 6. Some angels fell after the flood. And so it's not all one thing. But that a common opinion is that this material is either being misunderstood or not to be taken literally. And really, the opinion of many in Catholic history has been they all fell at the same time before humanity was even created. But that's not church teaching. That's a matter of opinion, so it's not a matter of dogma. And this can be understood in different senses.
Joseph, I hope that was helpful to you. At least I know that you had a lot on your mind, but we didn't have a lot of time to get to it all by the time we got you on. So thank you for the call. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much for 2 hours after I know it was a very busy day for you.
My pleasure. Always happy to be together with you and the listeners, Si.
All right. Check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World tomorrow because it's Weird Questions, and I'm on it. So that'll make me feel good if you check it out. Mysterious.fm. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.